time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to latalkradio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Bacon-Eating Fool.
Mr. Bacon-Eating Fool.
Some say it's just for breakfast. Oh, no, no, no. You know that any time is the right time to fry, microwave, or throw a heaping helping in the oven. Oh, connoisseur of sliced swine.
Cure that hunger with pure pork belly.
That's not bacon. It's bacon on bacon.
And it needs a little more bacon, yeah.
So the next time you crave a four-scene plateful of bacon brittle, a bacon-wrapped filet, bacon-covered pizza, chocolate-covered bacon, or a bucket of bacon bits, we'll tip our pork pie hat to you, Mr. Bacon-Eating Fool, a real American hero.
Mr. Bacon-Eating Fool.
You don't just eat bacon. You let it melt in your mouth like meaty candy.
Get ready for the best morning show on any kind of radio. Broadcasting live from the palatial studios of LA Talk Radio, get ready for Sam and Kara in the morning. Give Sam and Kara a call at 323-203-0815. And now, here are your hosts, Sam and Kara.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 9. We're here in the studio live yet once again, talking shit, making no sense.
That's funny,
but
Sam.
But you love spending time with us.
Way to come out of the gate with that. Talking shit. Talking trash.
Yeah, so today's the last edition of our two-hour format. And as I told you yesterday, we're going to go to 1 hour, starting at 10 to 11 on Monday. Monday through Friday, but starting on Monday. So today, I guess you could use just 1 hour today, huh?
Who, me? No.
Yeah. You look so tired.
No, I like the 2 hour, but I'm no comment.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss it, but it'll be good.
Yeah.
It'll be good. I gotta
so
be honest.
Are you, like, tired, or do you just look tired?
No, I'm tired. I went out last night. Mm-hmm. We went on a little adventure. I was supposed to go see a friend play at the House of Blues. Okay, mm-hmm. Here's the deal. Here is the deal. And I know this when I was doing the Comedy Store. If you're doing a lot of gigs where you're on the Strip or anywhere that involves high cost parking,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard for people to come out and see you.
That's
because there's no parking. I mean, on the Strip, there's really no parking. You can kind of find some off-street parking if you get there early,
mm-hmm.
And then you got to walk like 2 miles to get there. Or you can find meter parking and feed the meter till 10.
Right.
Okay, so it's either way, it's not like the most easiest place to go see a friend play.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's the cost of the cover, the parking, the two drink minimum, whatever it is. So anyway, last night just didn't work out. So we were going to go there, and then I was like, oh my gosh, I can't find parking. Well, honestly, I found parking, but it was like 2 miles away, and it was right in front of a really cool bar.
Yeah.
So I said, let's just go in the bar.
I see. Okay, so you gave up the House of Blues.
I did. We went to Barney's Beanery last night on Have you been there in Santa Monica?
No, I haven't.
Oh, really? It's
what is it, the bar?
Barney's Beanery.
Mm-hmm.
You've never been?
No, I've never been. I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's kind of like a staple, an LA staple on Santa Monica. We went there last night. It was interesting. We walked in, we had a drink, and what's interesting, and I'm sure you know this because you've lived in so many different places, some of the nightlife in different places is people go out and they meet people randomly, and the society kind of supports that. Whereas here in LA, everybody goes out with who they're going to go out with. And then they go out, and they mm-hmm. just stay with that person the whole night.
Right.
And they just talk to that person the whole night, and then they leave. Yet they're in a social environment, but they're not connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, I've heard New York people, you can go out and meet people, you know. It's a little bit more social.
Well, it depends who you are and who you're going with.
Yeah, but I mean, societally speaking, I've heard that it just fosters more those kind of meetings. Mm-hmm. Whereas, LA doesn't really necessarily do that. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting there, and we see these two dudes walk in. And they kind of did the same thing we did. They walk in, they're like looking around, like, what's this all about? And then they go grab a drink, and then they're just still looking around, kind of like, okay, this is our night. Mm-hmm. Ooh, night on the town.
And how do you know that? Did you follow them the whole
time?
No,
we just we were sitting down and we watched them. They did exactly what Sarah and I did. We walked in, we looked around, we got a drink. We're kind of like, oh, this is it? Okay, let's sit down.
Uh-huh.
Well, so we said, hey, why don't y'all sit down with us?
Mm-hmm.
And they did. And we started talking. And it turns out the one guy, we said, well, so what do you do or whatever? They're both from Turkey.
Oh,
and he said, well, you're not going to believe me if I tell you, so let me just let you Google my name on your phone. And I thought that was funny.
Google my name on your phone.
Anyway, he's a huge movie star in Turkey and in apparently Europe, I guess.
Yeah.
And he did. I mean, he showed us his stuff or what, not his like reel, but he showed us his, you know, his results and his
Google results.
Yeah, his Google results. Apparently he's a big deal. He said that, yeah, I do that because out here everybody's an actor and nobody really thinks you're really doing it,
yeah,
is what he said. And I said, yeah, I can understand that. Well, then later we're still talking. We had a good time. One dude's real short. This dude's tall. It's kind of like me and Sarah.
Yeah.
And we're talking and he said, do you remember my name?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. I said, look, man, you're a little into yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're a little drunk off yourself or something.
Why is that?
Because he had us Google him, and then he asked me later if I remembered his name.
Yeah, well, apparently he is full of himself.
I said, look, right? I don't have time to keep up. Like, you know, I said, it doesn't matter. If you are who you say you are, then that's who you are.
And besides, it's not a big deal because you don't know him. So.
I don't. It's not a big deal, and everybody's a big deal in L.A. I mean, you turn around and somebody's got something in the works or somebody knows something. It's just you become kind of desensitized.
Big star in Turkey, big fucking deal.
Well, I mean, hey, it is a cool deal. I mean, give credit where credit's due. If the guy has worked his way and that's what he's doing. And he's
But here he's nobody, you know?
I know, and I think that he wasn't trying to be somebody. I just think he wanted to be seen as legit because a lot of people aren't legit out here, you know? And anyway... And then he told me right afterwards, he goes, man, he goes, I've never had anybody just call me out like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, I think that's cool that you just told me that.
Yeah.
So, well, if you don't have to prove yourself. If you are that person, you are. And if not, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if you're such a big deal over there and everybody's, you know, clamoring to get something from you and talk to you. And he says people constantly ask him, like, what's the next plot on the show going to be? And, you know, like fans come to ask him all these questions.
Right.
You would probably think that you like coming to this. To states in the U.S. and not have people vying for your attention.
Right.
So you're welcome.
But he was looking for attention? Is that it?
I think he was a little bit, yeah. But anyway.
They're used to it, you know? I mean...
Either way, we had a really fun time. We ended up leaving that place and we went down the street to this place that has a little dance floor.
Yeah. Did they have a thick accent and everything?
They had an accent. It wasn't thick. It was like just an accent.
Right.
And we went down the street and got our dance on with these two dudes.
Oh, to a dance place?
Mm-hmm. Then we went to a dance place and we danced.
Uh-huh.
And it's really good.
What is it, like a nightclub or something?
Yeah, it's kind of like a bar with a dance room in the side room. If you've never been to Barney's Beanery, you've never been here, but it's called Bar Lubitsch. It's a really fun place.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, did that and it was just like really fun, good cardio too. If you go out and don't drink and you just dance for 2 hours, it's really good. You leave like a pool of sweat where your feet were and then you leave. It was fun.
So... Were they disappointed they didn't get anything at the end? Or
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, we were really nice about it. We were really cool and nice, but I could tell that, you know, of course.
Yeah. It's very unusual.
It is unusual. Well, I mean, I don't... Is it unusual? I mean, forget the whole, like, celibacy or whatever.
Right.
Pretend you don't know that about me.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really unusual you meet a girl at a bar and then you guys go dance and then she doesn't... it's so unusual she doesn't want to have a one-night stand.
Mm. No, I don't mean a one-night stand.
Yeah, that's
but,
what I
know.
Mean because they don't know anything about us.
Yeah.
I mean...
That's true.
You know,
yeah.
A one-night stand really is that...
So is that, you think, what they wanted, huh?
I don't know. I definitely think they enjoyed our company and we had great conversation and we all had a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
A guy's still a guy though, right?
That's true.
And,
a guy's still a guy.
And he's going to operate. It's like a hardwiring, the way a guy is operated, unless he has a different belief.
So do you feel at the end of the night that they did all this just to get lucky at the end? Like, be nice to you and talk to you and all this and take their time with you, just so maybe they can get lucky at the end?
Or
do you think
they
genuinely enjoy themselves?
I want to say yes and yes and yes and no is what I want to say, because I think that they really were like, hey, we're having fun. Let's keep going and having fun. I think that was legitimate. But I also think because they're dudes and they're like, oh, and hopefully we can go ahead and keep this party going and take it to a different level. I mean, I just expect that. And But they weren't, like, rude about it or too pushy.
Right.
I mean, they were kind of trying to get grabby on the dance floor, and that's just... I just act like I don't know what's going on. And yeah. I'm like, I dance really good, uh-huh. and I dance in my own crazy world, so I could easily just be like, I'm having some trance, and... start throwing elbows when I dance, you know, and, like, walk with a limp foot or something, and, you know, look like I've got some issues for a second and kind of push people away.
Yeah. Did they buy you drinks and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What?
I mean, the dating scene is just so predictable.
I didn't consider that a date.
No, not a date, but I mean, you going out, the singles life.
Okay? Yeah, it was fun, though. I felt like it was an adventure. I mean, I met a Turkish movie star.
Yeah.
Ta-da!
Turkish movie star.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess he is big where he is.
And you know what? Yeah. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah, so you weren't starstruck or anything.
How could I be, Sam?
I don't know.
I don't know the dude.
Yeah, but he was trying to impress you, you know.
He's that guy. He was trying to impress Sarah, too.
Yeah.
And the reality is he's that guy that's looking... I mean, you know, I think a lot of times... Put the act of sex aside, I think sexuality sometimes is like a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's people use it to measure... themselves.
Mm.
You know, it's about what are my boundaries and could I if I wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
Would this person let me, do they see me in that light?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times people use it in a way to, they're not, like, I could tell some guys do that to me. I'm like, I know they don't see me. I know they're not interested in me,
right.
But they'll come on to me, especially because I'm a strong personality, just to see if I'm going to be into them and just to kind of validate themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like more of a challenge to their masculinity.
Yeah.
It's not, hey, I'm really into you.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. More like I'm a dude and we just throw my dudeness around and see if you're falling for
my dudeness.
Falling for my dude vibe here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty much expected. You know, I think people think if women go out and stuff to a singles bar or something, they're probably also hoping to meet someone.
To a singles bar is a bar. What bar isn't single?
I don't know about that.
It's not a singles bar. What's a singles bar, Sam?
Oh, a singles bar is where people go out to pick up people. You know?
Yeah, but what's that?
Like a
meat
market type of thing.
Name one. What are they?
I don't know.
I mean, every bar by default would fall in that category in Los Angeles. I don't know about couples bar.
Okay.
Do you?
Whatever. I stand corrected.
Yeah, well.
What can I tell you?
Okay, that was easy. Okay, well, moving on.
So what time did you get to bed last night?
Like 2.
2 o'clock, wow.
Yeah, we were going to the House of Blues, and part of the ticket price was you go and you bring a canned food item, and then it's only $7.
Oh,
so we've dropped by a 7-Eleven and picked up a canned food and we put it in our purse. Then we ended up going to a different bar and I've got this thing of ravioli. And then at the end of the night, I was really hungry and I just opened up the ravioli in the car and ate a little bit of it.
You ate it right out of the can like that?
A little bit,
uncooked?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ravioli.
Yeah. I guess it is pre-cooked. It's just you have to
eat it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
it
just
up,
not
right?
It's not gourmet. I mean, chef boyardee, but still.
Yeah. But it's not like you have to cook it. You just heat it up, right?
No, it's just pasta and a little sauce.
Yeah, yeah.
A little sauce.
So that was your supper for the night?
Uh-huh. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
You got to get that food in after you dance like a crazy lady.
Yeah, I guess.
Did it sweating everywhere. It was good.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Does Sarah like dancing too?
Mm-hmm. She really does.
Yeah.
I ran into a couple comics I knew. It was really fun. It's a part of town I used to live closer to that area. And LA's so dense, I think, and concentrated that when you live in a certain pocket, you can tend to stay in that area and you become familiar with some of the people you see in that area.
Right.
And that side of town, that area, I just haven't been living in a long time, but I ran into older friends.
Mm, that's nice.
I know, it's fun. It's kind of like cool. Oh, I'm in a neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, a couple people.
So didn't you regret going to the House of Blues?
I mean, I do regret that I said I'd go and I didn't go. I feel bad about that. And I really do like his music. He's a friend of mine. But I kind of feel like, you know, it's kind of a lot to ask somebody.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm a performer too. I mean, I choose now when I do venues that I in LA. I mean, not out of town's different, but when I do stuff in LA, I try to make it as convenient for people to come as possible.
Right.
Like, what's a place that I can go and the parking's great and this is great and everything lines up? You're gonna have more friends or more people are gonna want to come out and you're gonna, you know, unless you're doing like you're headlining somewhere and you're not.
Yeah.
It's not like some LA's different, but other yeah. places. It's not.
See, that's what sucks about L.A., though, is that you don't have public transportation, you know, so you always have to find parking. Mm-hmm. In many other cities, you just take a cab or you take a bus or something,
yeah.
And you know, and you get there. Or a subway or something.
Well, having
you know?
A car here costs you a lot of money, man.
Yeah, I mean, the parking, too, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. it depends where you go. But still, relatively to other places, there's still, you know, all in all, in this town, there's plenty of parking, you know. It's just those condensed areas, like you said, you know, where people go out a lot. And, you know, the older areas where they never built parking lots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a problem. The House of Blues doesn't have a parking lot, does it?
No, they do. It's like $20.
Oh, really?
It's called valet.
Yeah.
Called sucks. $20? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm not doing that right now. Those days aren't happening for me yet. When they do, I'll just be like, keep it running in the front.
Yeah.
A little to the left. That's what I'll do.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I'll have a driver.
Did you go running yesterday at all?
I didn't get my run on. I actually got I was working and I got in tunnel vision. Do you ever do that? You get on the computer and you're just like, working on a lot of stuff. And so I got in tunnel vision and then we went out dancing. I was like, oh, that's fine. It counts.
Mm-hmm.
Just for like 2 hours.
What do you work on?
I work on like tons of stuff. You know, some of the stuff for us. Mm-hmm. I have day job stuff I work on for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I work on all my comedy stuff. Writing, editing my reel, things like that. My my website, stuff like that.
So you still have a day job?
I've got several little things in the fire and
really?
Pot. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I'm working this Saturday at have you heard the Lilith Fair?
No.
You never heard of Lilith Fair?
No.
That's this weekend. It's a... It's kind of like, I hate to say it's a lesbian event, but it kind of is. But it's a women's music festival that I think Sarah McLachlan is one of the founders of. And there's mm-hmm. great, great, great musical acts. But I think partly it's become kind of a female empowerment, and then part of it's like, I think, a lesbian thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure there's a much better, more PC way to put it. I'm just giving you my, you know.
Yeah.
Don't sue me.
Okay, I won't sue you.
I'm just making a joke because of having to be PC and stuff, you know. It's
yeah.
like, it's kind of like you're bound. You're like, Anyway, I'm working that event, and then I'm just lining up a bunch of that kind of work. It's promo work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun work.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cool.
So, I'm working on my website and things. And I actually wanted to get some of your help, but I know you're kind of bogged down.
Help on your website?
I want you to do some stuff, if you can help me with some photo stuff.
Photo stuff.
I want you to take the photos a few photos I have, and mm-hmm. I want you to. I don't know how to do this because I don't have Adobe Photoshop, but I'm working on my Mac,
mm-hmm.
and I want you to take out the background and then make my image just kind of suspended where I can put
you
it.
You really think I'm going to do that for you?
I don't know. Is it hard? I don't know if it's hard. I mean, I haven't asked you yet because I know you're really busy right now.
I'm going to have to find. How many pictures are we talking about?
No, just
here?
Like one or two images.
Oh, one or two images.
But is it hard work? Okay. Is that hard?
No, it takes time though.
Oh, it does? Really?
It does take time, yeah.
I just need like a couple like that are going to be standard where I can just put them on a background and they just mm-hmm. it just looks really sharp. Kind of like what you've done to our website, you know, with our
right,
photos.
Right.
How do you do that though? Do you need a special
you
program?
You have to mask the background and, you know.
Okay, well what
Yeah, do you it mean? Is some it does take some time, but maybe I'll do it for you.
Okay. I was going to ask you, but I know you're busy.
Yeah.
But what do you know? I just asked you in the air, so
All you have to do is just download some graphics program and use
oh, really?
The eraser and just like you kind of paint around it, you know?
That's all?
Yeah, it's pretty simple.
Well, then why are you giving me crap about it taking a long time?
Well, because...
I know you don't want to do it, but I'm saying is it long? It's not...
No, I said it's simple, but it does take time.
Oh, it does take time. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, shit.
Yeah, shit it is.
Well, shit. Talking shit. Oh, man. Didn't get my coffee in this morning. How are you people feeling out there today? Did you get your coffee in? What are you drinking? Don't make me jealous.
How come you didn't get coffee? Didn't have enough time?
I didn't have enough time. I was going to roll. And I was going to roll through McDonald's. Cause they've got kind of like their little cafe now.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm
That's
an idiot.
That's what I heard.
Well, they have, you know, coffees, mochas, lattes, things like that.
Right.
Iced coffee. And I was like, well, I could drive in, not have to get out. And I drove by and I was stupid to think I was just going to roll up
mm-hmm.
at, you know, 8:50.
Right.
We start at 9. 8:50 in the a.m., and get there, and there's like a sea of cars in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, I forget that in Los Angeles that some people work early. Well, because it's just a creative-driven town, so there's so many people have different
That's
odd
true,
hours.
That's people don't get up early.
Not at like your traditional place. I mean, yeah. You get out of LA. I go back to Texas. It really is. You know, the morning mm-hmm. there's people get up, they leave, and then the afternoon is dead. There's mm-hmm. nobody out. Not, yeah. I mean, not like it is here.
Mm-hmm.
You can go by noon at a sidewalk cafe, and there's a trail of people around waiting to be sat at this, you know,
right.
hip little restaurant
mm-hmm.
for lunch on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I saw this thing this morning. Did you hear that Mel Gibson is being probed on the domestic violence? Have you heard about that? Because, you know, he had this girlfriend that he...
like a new one, right?
Yeah, like that he left his wife for. And apparently he hit her in the face or something. So they... this happened a while ago, I think, but now they're like open an investigation on there. And he had this beautiful, beautiful girlfriend. But now, so, I mean, this guy has like 7 kids from his first marriage or mm-hmm. something. And now he's fighting for custody over an 8-month-old daughter that they had. You know, I mean, this guy's like, what, 54 years old? And he's still dealing with custody and shit, you know?
I'm kind of confused. So this is the girl that he was dating. He is dating, right?
He was living with her, and they had a baby together. They never got married, though. So she she alleged that he struck her in the face.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
I'd like to see him in fucking jail, you know?
Really?
Really would,
well, because
yeah.
that's because of the anti-Semitic thing he did?
Because of everything. He's just an asshole, man. I mean, hitting a woman and stuff, you know, that's not cool.
Well, we don't know if it's true, but if it is, yeah, that isn't cool. I mean, we don't know if
well,
it's true.
Well, she did get a restraining order against him, so they must have had some probable cause or something.
Well, man, 7 kids with it. How do you straight up have, how do you straight up have 7 kids with a woman and then divorce her?
Yeah, good question.
I just think there's something jacked up about that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe
Mel Gibson, you
know,
it.
Maybe like 1 kid in. I mean, I was thinking 5, 4, 3.
Yeah,
no.
But I think they had most of them before he got famous. You know?
No.
It's not like they're little kids. I mean, he's 54 years old. And
I don't care. It's the fact that you've been with this woman who's done the dirty work. She's done the hard work. She's labored your children, y'all's children mm-hmm. into the world. She's been there and done the grunt work. Mm-hmm. You know, what was that TV show that came out with Deborah Messing? It was called something Wife. It was the not First Wife. It was like I don't remember, but the concept was is that Starter Wife. She was the starter wife. She was there for her husband, and they got through law school. She got him through law school. Now he's a big attorney, and he has this lifestyle, and they've you know worked really hard together, and now he's ready for the good life, mm-hmm. and he like you know gets rid of her.
Yeah.
And he, you know, marries up a little nobody that just sits there and looks pretty and makes him look feel good or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done with her. Yeah. And it's just people using people. You know, oh, I need these kids. I want to have this kind of legacy. I want to have a household. I need somebody to be my crux while I'm building my career and I can lean on.
Yeah.
And really,
I don't think they set out to do that.
No, it just it happens. I'm not saying they set out to do it, but it's
once you become famous or successful, you know, it's like easier. You feel you have more power and stuff. Because I personally think that they probably always wanted to do that. It's just that they didn't, so they wait until they have the opportunity to, you know, and they can appeal to a younger woman. So, you know, it's not like it doesn't come as a surprise to me. You know, I think many people go through the same thing.
I mean, I know that women are obviously beauty is well, I mean, the youthful beauty is with youth, that element. But if you're not looking to have more kids, and do you really need to be with like a 21-year-old girl? I don't know how, you know what I mean? Why not just be with somebody that is attractive, but that you can have like good conversation with?
Because young meat is good.
Well, I don't know. Some people say, you know, wine ripens with age, so. I'm not saying go be with somebody that's Skeletor, but I'm saying like, hey, you're pushing 60 or you're whatever it is.
Yeah.
Come on now. Maybe you wanted to have a conversation with somebody that can talk in whole sentences.
Yeah. You see, that's the thing. I don't think it's about conversations. That's why usually it doesn't
last. Well, that's my question. I just thought that late in age.
Yeah. It's about, you know, having a trophy.
But he's already got trophies. Like, he's got all these Oscars and, like, you know, blockbuster movies.
Yeah, but men have to prove themselves, you know, with younger women.
It's so stupid, man.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. All right, we're going to take a short break in about half an hour or so. We're going to have a guest in the studio, and she wrote the book on DreamWorks Studio. You know who they are? Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, and Jeffrey Katzenberg. And apparently the studios were very promising when they started, but they failed miserably. And I'm really fascinated by this. So we're going to talk about that. But in the meantime, we'll take a break. We'll be back right after this.
On your computer, on your Wi-Fi radio, on your iPhone. Commercial-free original talk. Only on LA Talk Radio. Your favorite talk station.
Save the world. It's Sam and Tara in the morning. only on LA Talk Radio.
Okay. So, you know that we just released our iPhone app.
I love it.
I wanted to let everybody know who doesn't know yet, although the whole world seems to know by now, which I'm happy about, because God knows it's been coming a long time. So, it's not easy finding developers that will make a good application for you. And then finally I decided I'm going to design it myself and then just let people program the thing. So it's cool because now you can take the station with you and listen anywhere you want.
So you're saying you tried out a lot of people, and what was the problem?
Well, a lot of people want to charge you a lot of money for this, and then they plan to take a long time, and so I finally found a company that's good, and they specialize in radio and stuff. So
oh, that's so cool.
So that worked out cool, and but we got like some great response on it. You know, I mean, the sound quality is amazing and it's easy to use, and you can listen to both the channels live. I'm sure some people are listening right now. And then if you want to listen to archives, there's a link to the website and you just find the show you want. And so you pretty much can experience this on the road.
Does it come with a free iPhone? Because I kind of need that one.
Yeah. You know what? I went yesterday to the Apple store to try and get the new one because mine broke. So I figured I'll just go ahead and get a new one. And you have to wait in line. There's a waiting list. And you have to wait about 2 weeks to get one. That's how popular they are. They're so backed up. You know, they never expected to sell that many.
Seriously?
Yeah.
This is the iPhone?
This is the iPhone. They had like...
I thought this was like old news now. I thought that the iPhone is like, oh, we're onto the i4 or whatever now.
Yeah, but it's a new phone. That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's not just the iPhone. It's a new iPhone, so everybody wants it.
Oh, okay.
So they had about 500,000 pre-orders on it, and they still haven't been able to meet all the demand. Must be nice, huh, to be at Apple these days.
Yeah. What is going on with the i4? Have you looked into it? Do you know anything about it? I mean...
It's the i4. They don't call it i4. They call it the 4G or OS4, I guess. iPhone 4.0, whatever.
Yeah, okay.
All right. And I mean, it's got higher resolution, so everything looks really sharp. It's got camera that you can use with both sides, so you can take pictures of yourself and actually see what you're doing, you know, as opposed to another phone where you just have to turn it around and press the button and stuff. So it's cool because it's got like camera lenses on both sides.
These phones are getting to be crazy though. I don't mean to sound like a geriatric person that's like, oh, these days, these kids. But no, seriously, these phones are getting to be not only expensive. So if you lose it or break it, it's really a liability. I mean, to get it fixed or whatever. I know that the people had problems with iPhone. You couldn't just replace it. I mean, you had to rebuy the whole thing if you broke it or lost it, if it wasn't able to be repaired.
Yeah.
And so it's now becoming like this. It's this commodity that, I mean, it's big.
Yeah.
Little.
Well, it's a computer. I mean, when you think about this, you know, there's more power in this than in the IBM mainframes that they had like 50, 60 years ago. You know, and it's very powerful. You can do like video calls with it now.
Really?
Yeah. Video phone calls and that. So that's pretty cool, I think, you know. And but there's been reported problems with it. I don't know how they're going to address this, but apparently now it's got like a metal casing to it. And the antenna is inside the metal casing. But when you hold it in your hand, it sort of like cancels out the antenna. So the reception is bad, you know, which is like, how the hell did they not catch this when they were designing it?
Or before they went, hey, let's green light, let's go on this.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think something this basic, they would have caught this a long time ago.
Well, I know that from what I've heard, I mean, with the iPhone, is that usually the phone part of the iPhone sucks because there's so much, it's so dense with all this other stuff going on that the actual phone part kind of is janky.
Well, like, maybe in the beginning, but the one I have is actually pretty good. You know.
Really?
The,
you don't have bad problems with reception?
No, never. Never. It's actually pretty good.
I've heard a lot of people unhappy with the phone part of it.
Really?
But even if they're unhappy, they're like, it's still the iPhone.
Yeah.
They're like, I'll still take it.
Yeah.
My friend tried getting rid of hers so hard. In fact, I got involved in her quest because she was on with customer service. I'm really good with stuff like that. I get on, I go bypass the computer, bypass the 5 sales reps or customer service people that are trying to tell me no, and I get to the decision maker, and I get it done, usually, most most times. I'm pretty good at it. And so I was like, give me the phone. So I got on the phone, and I went down to this. I said, listen, she's paying for this, right? You get a check in the mail every month. It takes out of her account. Great, right? Guess what? She's not getting the product she's buying. What's that called? She can't get service. What's that called? It's called stealing, right? So you guys are stealing from her. You're taking her money.
Uh-huh.
You're not giving her the service and her product.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's thieving. You're a thief, right?
Is that what you tell them?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And I get
and
them.
I'm sure you get.
I get them understanding. I get them convinced. They're like, yeah, you're right. It is stealing. Okay, well, we need to work on this.
Yeah.
Only way to remedy this is to, you know, get her out of her contract with no this, this, and this. Or it is funny, but it works every time. Boom, 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 boom.
Mm.
But it's true. I mean, I'm not manipulating. It really is true. People pay money and then they get, you know, really jacked around in the red tape of everything and the bureaucracy, and people don't get their money back or this, that, and the other. And they find all these BS reasons to not refund people or X, Y, and Z. And at the end of the day, it's like, wait a minute. It took 2 seconds to take her money. You swipe a card.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it take, and this happened to my friend with a plane ticket. He's like, it took you 2 seconds to take my credit card information over the phone and process it, and it's instantly in your hands. Why is it then going to take 3 months to deprocess it and, you know, credit it back to my account?
Well, it's by design that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you don't buy into it. You go, no, 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 no. Or I'm going to dispute the charges. No, 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 no.
Yeah.
And they don't want you to.
Well, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You know.
Well, I'm not saying it's a fail-proof.
But we still, I think we have the best, you know, the best situation as far as being a consumer in this country. You know, I mean, you go to other countries, they're not even going to look at you.
Well, that's
when you want to
take it back. We're capitalists, of course.
You know?
It's supply and demand.
So there's capitalism anywhere. I mean, in many places.
Not like the U.S.
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
We run off of consumerism. So
there's competition, which keeps companies in line, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when I was in Israel, I went and bought a GPS, and I'm like, yeah, well, what happens if I don't like it or if it doesn't work the way I expect it to?
Too long.
And they're like,
bad.
Yeah, too bad. You know, if you take it out of the box, it's yours.
Oh, that's what they told you?
Yeah.
That's fine.
So I bought it anyway because you don't have a choice, you know. But that's why I'm saying, I mean, we really have it easy here when you think about it, you know. We just whine too much, I think, sometimes.
I disagree. Mm-hmm. I think, well, I do think we whine a lot. But I also think it's because it's our market. I mean, consumerism is what drives our economy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not that big on exporting. I mean, we are huge on, you know, supply and demand and boom, 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 boom. So it's kind of like
do you mean we're not strong in exporting?
Well, I mean, for the most part, I mean, you know, a lot of our income is through, you know, buying, right? Like a lot of what our economy runs off of are people buying. Consumerism, right?
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
But people are buying our stuff all over the world.
Yeah, but I mean,
you know. Well,
absolutely.
Whatever.
You know what I'm trying to say, though, right?
I think I know what you're
saying. It's like when they're talking about the recession and stuff and people aren't going to go out and spend money.
Yeah.
And how that's going to be a chain reaction.
But I think the main reason why we have it so good is because there's so much competition here. You know.
Yeah.
So what happens is if your competitor says, well, I'm going to give you a 30-day money-back guarantee, you're almost forced to do the same thing or you're going to lose a lot of sales. So that the competition drives a lot of the service that we do get. And for the most part, like I said, you know, I mean, yes, you're going to run into problems and all that stuff. But overall, the big picture is we really have it good here, you know.
Mm.
And you only have to get out of the country to find out that, indeed, that's why I always miss coming back here, you know, because it's so inconvenient when you go to other places, you know. So, yeah, as far as convenience, there's no, you know, and comfort, there's no place like the United States, by far, you know.
What was your biggest inconvenience when you were in Israel? Other than buying a GPS.
Parking, yeah. Parking is hard there. It's very
worse
difficult.
Worse than here?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? There's so many cars there, and this country was never designed to carry so many cars, you know. And when you think of all the new cars coming into the market every day, and not many cars getting off the road, you know, because they're too old or whatever, then you get a glut of traffic, you know, and it's tough, you know. So, I mean, for you it was tough in Sunset, but if you go somewhere else, many places in town, it'll be easy for you to find parking.
No, you're right.
You know, I mean, you go to a bookstore, there's parking lot. You go to the supermarket, there's parking lot. But even though they have them there as well, but they're so packed that you just never find anything, you know. So so that was inconvenient. And also the fact that, yeah, when you buy things, you can't take them back. Things are more expensive. And there's not a big variety of things, you know. Like, I looked for a universal remote control for my parents because their remote control broke. Couldn't find one anywhere. And it's not like they don't have electronic stores and stuff there. They have them all over the place. But, you know, so we go there. I mean, at least me, you know, I go there and I feel like I'm spoiled back home, you know, that we're used to all the conveniences and everything. And then you go somewhere else, you're out of your comfort zone completely.
Yeah.
But not that it's a bad thing, but, you know, when you travel, you just have to get used to wherever you are, you know, and accept it the way it is.
Did you do the Dead Sea thing?
No, I didn't.
How'd you not do that?
I thought that's because I didn't really go there to go on tours and stuff. You know, I mean, I've been there so many times when I was a kid.
You get a little sea bath going.
So,
a little hot little
sea
bath.
Well, my daughter ended up going there and she enjoyed it.
She did? Isn't the water warm?
Yeah, it's warm and you get to float on it. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's so many minerals in the water. So nothing is alive in there, and it just makes you float. So it's pretty cool. And then my daughter bought some of that mud. You know, they put in packages, and you can buy it.
Uh-huh.
The mud that you put on your body and stuff. Uh-huh. It's supposed to be very healthy for you.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So when you float on it, is it like horizontal or like...
Yeah, horizontal, yeah.
But what about vertical?
Vertical. You probably would float too.
It's just so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, vertically you would float, but I mean, it's more fun when you lie on your back like you're on a raft or something.
Yeah, but you could swim through it and you could kind of bob up and down a little bit.
Yeah. You know that it's the lowest point on Earth, right? There's no lower point than the Dead Sea.
Really?
Yeah. Like below sea level.
Really?
Yeah. And it's a result of, like, you know, earthquakes from millions of years ago that went through the whole region. And that's why you have that sort of, like, crack there, you know, going through. So, yeah,
I mean,
it's
very interesting. But, like, where's the water come from?
Oh, there's a river that feeds into it. But the water level is pretty low now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's sort of, like, goes and disappears almost.
So the Dead Sea, like, how big is it? Like a
it's
sea?
No, it's more like a huge lake than
okay.
anything. Yeah,
yeah,
you can see the end of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, but they call the Dead Sea, so I thought it was like an ocean.
Yeah, that's what they call it, but, you know.
Is the water blue?
Kinda. It's more like clear.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that deep, so it doesn't get that blue, I guess. You know.
And there's not one fish in there, huh?
Not one fish. Nothing can live there.
Really?
Yeah. That's why they call it the Dead Sea.
It's so interesting, though. And so when you're in it, though, you just... I guess you don't have to worry about like anything biting you.
No, no. But, yeah, that's the thing. When we went to the beach, to the Mediterranean, I was irritated. We couldn't go in the water because, first of all, well, you know, the sea was pretty rough. So they don't let you in that far into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a lot of jellyfish there. Washing out to the shore, so you're like swimming around jellyfish, and you don't know when you're going to get stung.
That sucks.
Yeah, but man, the water was so nice and warm and clear, you know, just like in the Caribbean.
Really?
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Oh man, that's so cool.
Yeah, and the sand is like so fine, you know, not like here. You know, here it's pretty like thick stuff, you know, but there it's like baby powder almost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really cool.
But there's big-ass jellyfish everywhere.
Yeah, well, not always. I guess this is the season or something for them, but eventually they're gone. But this time, yeah. So I didn't really enjoy the sea that much, but we are on the beach and there's people around and stuff, so it's pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
It was relaxing.
You probably can get a tan really good, too, because you're olive.
Oh, yeah.
I
forgot to take... Oh, you mean me personally?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I... my body's pretty white, I guess, you know, because I don't go in the sun shirtless or anything unless I go to the beach, which I don't do often. So I was actually burning there. You know, I didn't put any sunblock or anything. So now my skin's peeling on my shoulders. But yeah, there's a lot of tourists there and stuff. And the funny thing is, my daughter reminds me, as we went there, I couldn't find parking, so I wanted to turn around and go home. You know?
Oh, really?
I was so irritated.
You're like, I'm done. I'm done with this beach.
Yeah, you know.
Damn
so,
beach.
But we found, you know, there's a mall next to it. So we just parked there and we went. And it was nice, you know? And then, you know, we took trips and stuff to, I showed her around Tel Aviv. And
oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it's like the contrast there is so amazing. You know, you see some of these high rises that are ultra modern, great malls, you know, everything like foreign merchandise, American, and, you know, like the Gap and, you know, what's it called? And Fitch, what's the...
Abercrombie and
Fitch. Yeah, Abercrombie and Fitch and all that, you know. So, and then you have... And then you go to certain parts of it, and it looks like you're in Mexico or something, like in some little town in Mexico, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with the vendors and everything and cheap stuff.
I met an Israeli dude when I first moved out here, and he was really cute, and when we hung out for a while. I was so young. I was just, like, didn't understand anything about guys then either. It was just young, and I didn't understand, like, I mean, I knew dudes were dudes, but I just gave them way too much credit. I was like, oh, they're good. Oh, they're good. You know, I didn't realize, like, how aggressive guys are as far as how they're, I just didn't get it. I was really young.
Yeah.
And so I'd buddy
people
up.
Are aggressive there, though, you know, and they come here, and they're like that. You
well,
know?
I think a lot of the men are really attractive. I mean, well, when I first started to meet a lot of men that were Israeli or Persian when I moved out here, I realized mm-hmm. different countries, but you know, the darker features, mm-hmm. They're striking, you know, they can be very striking.
Yeah.
And that was different from coming from Texas, where mostly I was around, you know, white people, some black people, and you know, what were the other ones? Hispanic and like mm-hmm. Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty basic. Like, there weren't Jewish people that
right.
I was around.
Not a lot of Jews in Texas, huh?
I think Houston's probably different. Houston
yeah.
has a lot of everything.
The bigger cities do, yeah.
Yeah, Houston, I think,
small
is
towns.
Different. But, I mean, not a lot of Jewish. So it was really cool moving here because I met so many people from so many different parts of the world
mm-hmm.
that were cool. Like, I never met anybody, any Persian people.
Mm-hmm.
I never met Jewish people.
Yeah. No, you definitely
Israeli.
Meet all of them here in L.A., you know?
Yeah, I met
or
some
in
really,
New York, you know?
Yeah, I met some really cool people, but I met this one dude that I really was attracted to for a while, and he was from Israel. And he was cute. He was really cute.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I bet the guys are kind of hot over there, huh?
Yeah, well, I never look at him that way, but being there with my daughter, she made me...
Did she say, Dad, those guys are cute?
She made me realize, yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the women are pretty hot there too, you know.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I bet. I lived in an apartment with became close to a brother and sister that were from Israel, and they were both just really sun kissed and good looking and
yeah
and cool, just laid back.
Yeah,
cool, fun people.
Yeah.
Both did their military time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to see how crowded Tel Aviv gets, I mean, it's like the city that never sleeps, pretty much, you know?
Well,
I mean, it's
New
like...
New York.
I know, you told me that, but what I'm saying to you is that it's also known as that. And so one night there, they had like just this big annual celebration that they do in the city. So I thought, I'm not even getting close to that town, you know? I mean, forget about it. But my daughter, you know, with a couple of friends and stuff went... And they couldn't even get around anywhere. None of the buses would stop at their bus stops because they were full. You couldn't get a cab. And then after 2 hours, they were able to get a cab, and it was going nowhere because there was such traffic jams there. So, you know, I mean, how
That's
can you...
That's crazy. And
yeah,
that's because of the annual festival?
Yeah, what kind of quality of life is that? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, like, the whole city was just full of celebration and stuff, which sounds fun, you know? But... But
well, it's
kind of
like the West Hollywood, what's the Halloween parade that they do every mm-hmm. year that's like world renowned, and everybody drives
the
up.
The Pride parade?
No,
mean?
Not the Pride. I'm talking about the Halloween.
Really?
The Halloween. Mm-hmm. Have you been there?
No, not on
Oh my
Halloween.
Gosh. I mean, we live in a town of Hollywood, and so mm-hmm. all the costume designers and makeup artists live here. So people go, I mean, people are walking on stilts, and they're like in Pan's Labyrinth, mm-hmm. extensive intricate costumes. I mean, it's really amazing. And then there's wacky stuff, and there's just, I mean, there's just high quality costumes. And people don't play here. They bring out the guns.
Yeah.
And people drive from all over and go to this parade and festival. And I mean, I used to live right over in West Hollywood, and I was like literally, I don't know, a block from my house, and it took me an hour to get home. Mm-hmm. In my car, and I thought, and I didn't even go to the festival. I just took a wrong turn.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming home, and I took a wrong turn. Mm. And I thought, you know, I'm just not doing this.
Yeah.
I'm never gonna go to this parade. It just kills it for you.
Yeah.
You're like, it just, I can't even enjoy this.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Now, have you been watching the World Cup?
No, just part of it. I don't know. I mean, I think was there a game yesterday?
I don't think so. No.
I don't know. Let me see. But there's a couple of games left, I
guess. Clearly you haven't been watching it.
No, but when I was overseas, everybody watches it.
Well, no, it's cool. Like, I was driving, was it 2 days ago, and there was, you know, there's people, the bars are packed, people are having fun. I just like the environment of it. I got back on, what was it, Tuesday, we went to the Montalban Theater, which is in Hollywood, and they were having, Nike was doing this really awesome event for the World Cup. I think they're still doing it, where you get free beer or coffee. And it's on this big screen theater, and then they have everybody's on one side that's for, you know, let's say Spain, and the other side's for Germany or whatever.
Right.
You dress up, and people get super, super into it.
So did Spain win, or did the Netherlands win? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
No, I thought it was
here.
Spain and Germany.
I'm sorry, Spain and Germany.
And I think
no,
Spain.
Wait a minute.
I think Spain won.
Spain versus the Netherlands. Okay, they haven't played that yet.
Yeah, no. I think Spain won against Germany.
Yeah, so no, Spain is against the Netherlands, and then whoever wins goes up against Germany, because Germany already won against Uruguay. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just not into
it. So there's a couple of games left. I know. I mean, nobody here is into it, you know, and people were trying to get involved a little bit, you know, when the U.S. was playing Ghana, but we lost, so.
Yeah. We have 10 brands that may disappear in 2011 that the Wall Street comes out with. This is interesting.
Brands that will disappear?
They're just saying basically they may be gone by 2011, and they may go into Chapter 11. You know, and it's basically bankruptcy, things like that. So this is just what they are expecting, you know, kind of forecasting. And one is Reader's Digest, if anybody still reads that.
Yeah, you think anybody still reads that? I guess all the you know, some people in the Midwest and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I picture.
I mean, but it's just such a staple. I mean, it's been around forever. Get this one. Blockbuster.
Yeah.
It used to be the leader, you know, the leader in video and rental business.
Yeah. But that's not a surprise, you know?
No, and it's just, you know, now you have, it's falling rapidly next to people like, obviously, Netflix, and companies like Redbox.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Redbox?
No, not with Redbox.
It's not that big out here, but it's big like where my aunt lives. It's basically you go to McDonald's or a freaking 7-Eleven or whatever, and there's this machine that's called...
The vending machine.
Yeah,
okay,
the vending
I've
machine, and you rent a movie and you return it.
Right.
Kind of
cool.
Yeah,
I've seen those. But, you know, now with Netflix and stuff, who the hell's going to go to a video
store?
Yeah,
Netflix,
you know?
Is still... But that's still kind of like an in-between thing if people aren't ready for Netflix.
Well, they all already started. Oh, I see. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, even with Netflix, eventually they won't even send you discs anymore. They already have like streaming movies.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a selection. I mean, there's not a lot of them. But, yeah, I mean, what's the point in even having the physical media when you don't really need it, when you can stream wirelessly to your TV?
Yeah, they're looking at possibly T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, really?
Yeah. It's apparently a Dutch company, it's part of a Dutch company owned, and it is the number four cellular company in the American market, and it just talks a lot about the figures and that it only had a profit of $300 million in 2009, mm-hmm. which is down from $483 million in 2008, and it's still
very profitable.
Yeah, well, it says T-Mobile not only faces three large competitors, it also has to begin to offer 4G service to compete with Sprint's new WiMAX service and LTA-based products.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that whole, you know, we just talked about the 4G, whatever, 3G, whatever it's called,
yeah.
all that fancy shit. They got to get up with the times shit. T-Mobile, you got to get up with the times. You need to get off the damn market. We ain't got time to be jacking around with your rinkety-dinkety walkie-talkie cell phone. This ain't 1992. Get with a damn time. Shoot.
So I was telling you that I decided to start getting into TV shows and stuff,
okay,
right?
Okay, update me.
So last night I'm like sitting in what comes on? Big Brother. And it's the first show of the season,
oh,
right?
Oh, okay. So you got
did you ever
it.
Watch that?
Yeah, my friend gets like obsessed with that show.
You see, I only watch. I mean, it's the 12th season of it, you know, so it's been around for a while.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think I only watched the first three or something, first three seasons. And so I didn't even know it was still around. And then last night it comes on, and you know what? This thing sucks you in like drugs, you know?
Yeah.
It's like I couldn't stop
it's
watching
trash.
It.
It's trash TV.
It's trash, but I couldn't stop watching it.
I can't judge because I got some trash guilt.
Because
but what did you
the
think?
Characters there, I mean, I don't know how they pick them, man, but they've gotten really good at getting the right people together.
Yeah.
So it's still kind of a cheesy show, but like I said, you know, it's like a train wreck. You can't stop watching it.
Well, I don't know what it is. There's something about watching people, you know, that have an outlandish life or mm-hmm. an outlandish personality, and you just watch them like they're in a circus.
Mm-hmm.
And you pay your little ticket and get your cotton candy.
Yeah.
And you get your peanuts and you laugh and you watch. And it's like they're not. It's kind of weird that we love it so much.
Yeah.
It's very voyeuristic. Obviously, the show is based on voyeurism.
No, it is, you know. It is.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've got all bimbos there.
Which you love. But you yeah. love it.
The, both the guys and the girls are bimbos there.
I know, but it's kind of weird that, like, we love watching that. What does that yeah. mean? You know what I mean? The
yeah.
fact that, you know.
Well, they're nice to look at, you know. That's the thing.
I don't
thing.
Think
I
it's
mean,
just the looking,
if
though.
You, if you look at Survivor and all these shows where they walk around naked, they always pick out the ones that have great bodies, you
well,
know.
Well, yeah, of course. Watch, but, you know, I mean, there's overweight. Something about the fact that there's something ridiculous about their the way they think, the way they act, the way mm-hmm. they talk. There's usually something so ridiculous. Or I mean, I've seen shows where. Gosh, MTV started pumping out some really dumbass shows mm-hmm. where it, you know, it was like a gentleman's club or something. It was about taking guys that are thugs and turning them into like gentlemen or whatever. And it was just the funniest people.
Yeah.
I mean, the funniest people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So.
But I mean, they've sucked me in for the season now. I've got to keep watching.
Oh, so there you go. There you go. You're getting it going.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
All right. We're going to take a break. Hopefully, our guest is here. We're going to talk to Nicole Laporte, who wrote the book, The Men Who Would Be King. And so stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
get back. Let's get back to Sam and Kara in the morning.
Kara in the morning.
Right here on LA Talk Radio.
All right, then we have Nicole in the studio. It's LaPorte, right? Or
yes.
LaPorte. Okay.
LaPorte, yeah.
Okay.
Just like a city I grew up near.
Really?
In
where?
Texas. You're much prettier, believe me. It wasn't pretty city, girl. It wasn't pretty city. But back to you.
Yeah. So welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You wrote to us about the book, and the book you wrote, The Men Who Would Be King. And I was thrilled to have you in because I did see it in the bookstore, and I was about to buy it, you know. So I thought, gee, we'll get a free book in the process.
There you go. I've got many more boxes.
Really?
You know, give me names, and I'll send them out.
So the book is about DreamWorks Studios and Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Giffen. How did you become interested in this?
I was a reporter at Variety for many years, and I actually covered them as a film reporter. So, you know, Variety, you divide up the studios. So as a reporter, you're covering, say, Sony and DreamWorks, and, you know, you just kind of, you know, you're always meeting with executives there. You're writing about the movies that are coming out. So you really get to know a studio very well. And DreamWorks was just always very different from the other studios. You know, it was independent. It was privately owned. It had these titans running it, Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And they were just very unique, you know, very private. When you go to the studio, it's like going to a spa. It's like you drive onto the Universal lot, and it's just this gorgeous, you know, it's all kind of Santa Fe-type bungalows, and there's free food everywhere. I mean, it's just this amazing kind of utopia in the middle of Hollywood. And so there was always that sort of image that it had. And then, but as I covered it and as I learned more about it, it was also incredibly dysfunctional and just a lot of madness behind the scenes, and, you know, its attempt to sort of not operate the way other Hollywood studios did, you know, with hierarchies and traditional bureaucracy, actually led to this very crazy management and just a lot of weird things going on. So I thought, what a great story.
Yeah, so this is stuff you found out while you worked for Variety, right? Which is a trade publication for Hollywood, pretty much, right?
Yeah, I mean, most of that's how it started. So when I started actually writing the book, I worked for another year or so as at Variety, and then I actually left and just focused on the book for like two more years. So it was a combination. I mean, actually, most of my research was after I left, when I was really able to kind of sit down with people and go through old documents and, you know, read books and, you know, really do kind of more extensive research.
Yeah. So, but as soon as I started writing the book, I thought this is not just an ordinary book here because, you know, I expected this to be, you know, all about how nice they are and how great they are and everything. And early on in the book, from the first page, you realize these guys are not happy about the book at all.
No. They did not want this book to happen. I mean, the thing about DreamWorks is it ultimately was, in many ways, a failure, just in that it set out to be, you know, it was formed in 1994. These guys were at their height. Spielberg had just won his first Best Picture Oscar for Schindler's List. He had just made Jurassic Park, which was the highest grossing film of all time. Jeffrey Katzenberg had just been fired from Disney, where he turned the studio around with Michael Eisner. He had overseen, you know, the revival of these animated films like Aladdin and Little Mermaid. David Geffen was a billionaire. I mean, they are titans now, and they're three of the most powerful men in Hollywood today. But at that moment, they just were really untouchable. And so the news that they were going to come together and form this studio was just huge. I mean, it was the first studio to be filmed
very
in 60
exciting.
Years. Yeah.
Right. The first one in 60 years.
In 60 years, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So everyone went crazy. I mean, they were on the cover of Time. And you know, they wanted to be more than just a studio. They wanted to be this sprawling empire and make, you know, TV shows and records and video games and have this studio of the 21st century out in Playa Vista. I mean, it was just so huge and ambitious. And ultimately, it didn't work, you know, and they had to scale all of that back. They were ultimately sold to Paramount. So, you know, no one wants to write a book, or no one wants to see a book written about this huge venture that didn't work.
Right.
So that was part of the problem. And then they're just very secretive or very private, very controlling. You know, they didn't want someone snooping around their business, so they made it very clear they didn't want to talk to them.
Do they have people like sitting outside of your apartment and or house and filming and watching and black cars following you. Did it get to that? Dead cats and stuff?
If it did, I wasn't aware. But I was, I mean, I did go through moments of kind of paranoia because it's almost like other people would make me scared. You know, you'd just be talking to me like, oh my God, you know.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to talk about it, huh?
Not a lot of people were really, really scared. But I remember having drinks with someone once and they were sort of kidding, but sort of not. And they were like, well, you know, your phone's tapped. And I was like, and then I remember driving home. Of course, I had a few drinks, and I was dying to call my husband, but I thought, but my phone's tapped. I can't call him.
Oh, that's funny.
So it's still, you know, you have these, and then you realize how ridiculous
you're
being.
So it made you paranoid, huh?
Just moments, but, you know, ultimately, it's just, you know, you get caught up in the hype.
Right.
So I'm more concerned or interested, like, your motivation with the book is that you had a relationship with the studio for a few years reporting, and then you, I'm sure, developed, you know, personal relationships with people there and were able to really see the ins and outs. And what was your biggest fascination with it as far, was it the fact that it was supposed to be an empire and then it didn't? Is that the biggest thing? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that was probably the main, you know, just in terms of the bigger arc or what is the story. The story is, you know, the question, you know, I guess I wanted to answer the question, what happened and why didn't it work? I mean,
okay.
When you put these three guys together, how, you know, as everyone thought at the time, well, of course it's going to work. I mean, they're geniuses, they're brilliant, their track records are incredible. So how could that not work? So that was kind of the main question I wanted to answer. And then also just, you know, beyond the studio, some of them, I mean, they did have some great films like American Beauty and Saving Private Ryan and Gladiator. And in the course of my reporting, you know, I just heard, you know, just crazy behind the set stories from like Gladiator and Russell Crowe being a complete maniac. And American Beauty, which was their first Best Picture Oscar, how that film barely got made. And it was just this... You know, so that within it, there were kind of these really colorful stories that I just thought, wow, that's just good material. It's just this would just make for like a fun, lively, you know, interesting book about the business.
Now, what drew them together? I mean, how did this come about where they decided to build the studio?
Well, what a lot of people say is that DreamWorks was formed because Jeffrey Katzenberg needed a job. Jeffrey,
I see. Okay.
It's that simple.
He was booted out of Disney, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
He was booted out in 94.
Can you discuss that a little bit with Michael Eisner? I mean, what happened there? Because he was like the number two guy pretty much, right? I mean, he was like, what did he call him? He called him my golden retriever or something,
yeah,
right?
That didn't go over too well. Yeah, Jeffrey was, you know, in the 80s, he and Eisner went there in 1984, and for the next decade, I mean, they turned that place around. When they got there, it was just, you know, Walt had died, and no one had really gotten beyond Walt Disney, the icon. And, you know, people would say that, you know, when questions would arise, people would say, well, what would Walt do? You know, this is in the 80s. This is years after he's died. So it was just stuck in the past. And, they got there and turned the place around, you know, made it into this global giant. As I said before, Jeffrey was really involved with the animated films and bringing these films back to life. You know, he and Eisner worked hand in glove. What happened was Frank Wells was sort of between the two.
And who was Frank Wells?
He worked with Eisner. He was technically the number two, sort of above Jeffrey and below Eisner. And he was just a very beloved figure. And people sort of would describe him as the marriage counselor between Jeffrey and Michael Eisner, because those two just have really different personalities, and they're both just very intense guys. And Wells was kind of the more low key guy who was happy to be behind the scenes and sort of helped sort of ease their relationship. He then died in a helicopter crash, tragically, and Jeffrey expected to be promoted and be number two because he worked his ass off for the last 10 years. And then Eisner ended up not selecting him. So it was just this really kind of heartbreaking, tragic moment. You know, Hollywood was shocked, and suddenly this guy was betrayed by this man who was almost like a father figure to him, who he had promised, actually, Jeffrey, that he would give him the job, and then he didn't. So it was this really kind of shocking moment in Hollywood. And, you know, at that point, David Geffen, who's always acted as Katzenberg's mentor, and Spielberg, who was a friend, kind of swooped in, and, you know, it was sort of, they came up with this idea of, well, you know, why work for something? Let's just create a studio.
Right, right. Now, was there ever a time with when Katzenberg and Eisner did get along? I mean, it must have been, right? Because they were able to turn the studio around and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely had a complementary relationship. And you know, no one works harder than Jeffrey Katzenberg. And so, you know, you want that guy working for you. So, yeah, they did get along. But I think it was always sort of, there was always... a bit of antagonism, especially as Jeffrey became sort of more high profile, and Jeffrey likes to get credit, and Jeffrey had a lot of loyal people putting his name in the press, and I think that, you know, the more powerful he got and the more sort of high profile he became, Eisner started to resent that, because they both love the spotlight, so Jeffrey was kind of becoming a little too close for comfort, and so in those later years, I think that's sort of what really started bothering Eisner. You know, when it was written about in the press, when Lion King was this huge hit and the highest grossing animated film of all time, that, you know, that Jeffrey had done that. You know, I don't think Eisner liked reading that or hearing that, but that was the message that was being put out.
Right. Was that the case, do you think?
Katzenberg definitely oversaw that film. I think the way his people spun it was giving him more credit than he actually deserved. Mm. When he got to DreamWorks, he was, in fact, every day in the animated studio and working, hands-on on those films. At Disney, though, he oversaw animation, but he was also, he was overseeing everything. He was overseeing TV, he was overseeing live-action films. So, you know, in talking to people, they said, you know, Jeff would be there maybe two times, three times a week, but he had so much other, you know, there was no way he could just be, you know, solely concentrating on The Lion King. So I think it was a bit hyped that he had such a hand in its success, but it was certainly something he was involved in, and he did oversee it. So
right now, when I was reading this, and that's pretty much outlined in the beginning of the book, this whole thing with Eisner, I was wondering, I mean, how could it be that he would sort of betray him, you know? I mean, how is it that you turn your back on someone?
Hollywood.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Come on, that's what you do.
Yeah, that's what my roommates do all the time. We just know it's part of the game, you know? Just watch your back.
Friends, enemies.
Keep those enemies close. I'm playing with the roommates if they're listening. But
so you think he felt threatened by him?
I think so.
Really?
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then Jeffrey Katzenberg gets all... I think justifiably, you know, gets upset with all this. Mm. And now, did he decide to leave, or was he really kicked out?
Well, basically what happened is Eisner, there was a press release drafted that said, that sort of got rid of his job, that promoted Joe Roth, who was under him, to a more senior position, and suddenly there was no job for Jeffrey. So it was sort of not officially fired, but sort of fired.
Yeah. The job you show up for every day with that coffee cup and stuff, it's just not going to be here.
Yeah.
I mean, you could show up, but...
Right. It's just,
Yeah, it's decorative.
Yeah. When I worked at Variety, they have a great word they use. It's called ankled. So if you say... And it's never clear whether that means someone was fired or they quit.
Uh-huh.
So it's a great Hollywood term, because so many times, so often, they say they quit, but actually, you just never know.
Right.
He ankled.
Yeah, he ankled. So, and at the time, Steven Spielberg, you said, just had done Schindler's List and Jurassic Park and stuff. So now why would he, I mean, did he feel a need to go on his own at that point before he got together with Jeffrey?
Yeah, I think for Steven, it was, what was appealing to him was this idea of being a studio owner and having a studio of his name and, driving through gates, that said, his company or his name on it. It was sort of, Spielberg is very nostalgic. He loves old Hollywood and, the idea of, back in the 20s and the 30s with Jack Warner and Sam Goldwyn and these men who... had these, where the studio was like their homeland, as Spielberg likes to say. So I think for him it was, to not just be a director for hire, who has a production company that's paid for by Universal, but to actually be an owner, to be sort of, an elder statesman in Hollywood, to make that leap from, the filmmaker to the studio owner. Mm-hmm. And also owning his films. I mean, to really sort of, you know, be, you know, take that next step.
Right. So, I mean, it makes sense. You know, you kind of want to have your own company when you become successful and everything. But I think it's also important to know that these guys are more like creative types, right? I mean, they're not like necessarily business people, or maybe David Geffen is a little different. But so tell us a little bit about David Geffen also. Where was he at the time in his life?
Geffen was, I mean, he was quasi-retired, actually. You know, he had done so much in music. He'd formed Geffen Records, Asylum Records. He'd worked with everyone. And at that point, he, you know, he was worth $1 billion, and he really wasn't doing much. He was sort of up in Malibu, you know, fielding interview requests and, you know, hanging out by the pool. So I think for him, the appeal was to get back in the game, you know, and, you know, he's someone who likes to be on the pulse of everything, likes to be involved in everything that's going on, likes to be a real active player. And so this was an opportunity for him to, you know, leave the, you know, to come inside from the swimming pool and actually, you know, to make some films and just, you know, get back in there. And I think for him to be aligned with someone like Spielberg was a very big deal. You know, Geffen started out as an agent. I mean, he understands more than anyone what that means when you have, you know, the 900-pound gorilla as your partner. So I think, you know, that's sort of what got him interested.
Right. Now, I find him to be a very fascinating character because you were talking a little bit about him being vengeful and everything. Like, you don't want to cross him,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, can you recall anybody that really felt the brunt of his anger?
Let's say. Michael Ovitz, you know, as the story, as the Hollywood gossip mill likes to say, you know, was destroyed by Geffen.
Really?
Whether you want to believe that or not, but, you know, at one point he was literally called the most powerful man in Hollywood. You know, he co-founded CAA, he was at the top of the world, he then went to work for Disney. Of course, it was a disaster, but, you know, where is he today?
He's, yeah, that's
no career.
True.
And Geffen, you know, and it's in my book, but, you know, I did talk to people close to Geffen who said that he outright said this, I am going to destroy Michael Ovitz. And
really?
There were whisper campaigns. And, you know, Geffen works in a very behind-the-scenes way. You never know. He's very good about not leaving his fingerprints. But he's incredibly influential. He has a lot of people loyal to him. And, you know, I gotta believe he did have something to do with Michael Ovitz's fall.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, how many people have, I mean, you've got a lot of sources and you don't really name most people and stuff. My question is, well, what was my question, Kira? I totally lost my train of
Geffen.
Thought.
It's Geffen stuff.
I know.
You're on the Geffen part.
Geffen's working
I'm
on
I'm learning.
You.
I'm just sitting back in this story time because I'm kind of like, I guess I'm like, damn, this rabbit hole goes pretty deep, huh?
Now you don't have to read the book.
Yeah.
Just,
so I remember what I wanted to ask about. How many sources did you actually talk to, would you say?
Over 200.
200?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And these are people that worked next to them or in close proximity to them, right?
Yeah, it was, every, you know, anyone who had ever done business there, worked there, it, you know, I talked to a lot of filmmakers, and a lot of the filmmakers actually went on the record because they wanted to, you know, they were proud of their films and or their TV shows or whatever, and, you know, they wanted to talk. So Sam Mendes, who directed American Beauty, talked on the record, Gore Verbinski, David Franzoni, who wrote Gladiator. I mean, there were actually a lot of on-the-record sources. But
were these sources any more complimentary to the guys, or were they critical at times too?
They were quite honest. You know, I mean, they had pretty good experiences. But I mean, you know, Sam Mendes was very open about the fact that people were really skeptical about American Beauty, and that, you know, he didn't really feel the studio was behind him. Until, of course, they saw the movie, and then everybody loved it. You know, but he talked about how while they were filming, an executive came on the set, and, you know, Kevin Spacey's in the film, and Sam overheard the executive say something like, oh, well, let's just shake hands with Kevin and get out of here.
You know,
and it was just this movie nobody cared about. So I think people were pretty honest,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Well,
and even, by the way, even people who were nervous just because, oh my God, what is Steven going to do? I'll never work in Hollywood again if I talk to you on the record. A lot of those people were complimentary too. It wasn't just like, you know, all off the record, angry sources. I mean, people were quite very honest, but it wasn't just a bunch of people trashing the studio. And I think that comes across in the book. A lot of people had really complicated feelings. I mean, they went to DreamWorks really buying into this dream, and it didn't work out. You know, so there was disappointment, but there was also great pride. I mean, people who work at DreamWorks loved at one point that company. I mean, there was incredible pride when you worked there, and you got to work with Steven, and you know, so it was interesting, but it just wasn't so simple as, oh, it's all off the record angry people. It was very kind of, you know, it was a lot more nuanced, I think.
Yeah. Now, among the three of them, who is the one that really initiated getting together and building this company? Which one of them?
Katzenberg was the one who really kind of, once this idea was out there, he made it happen. Because I think Steven kind of joked about it first, like, oh, Jeffrey, you know, don't worry, you're going to be fine. Go start your own studio. And, you know, Bob Zemeckis said something like, oh, you know, you two should get together. And everyone kind of laughed about it. But Katzenberg really took that germ, and Geffen had told him too, like, you don't need to work for anybody, just go to do your own thing. Yeah. And he's the one who really, you know, worked on those two guys, because there was a little reluctance. You know, I think both Geffen and Spielberg were a bit nervous and not sure, and you know, but Jeffrey really kind of met with them and just planned it. And then he, of course, was the workhorse, and I think it was clear that they weren't going to have to do that much. You know, he would, don't worry guys, I'll take care of it, you know.
Right.
And he works, and he really kind of was the sweat equity in that company.
Right. And now, as it turned out, was it really his gig, or were they actually more involved or as involved as he was with the company?
No one was more involved than Jeffrey, just in terms of day-to-day running, you know, being there for all the meetings, like getting everything, you know, just making sure the trains were running and things were happening. But Spielberg, you know, the other two guys just had their respective roles. And Spielberg, you know, he was kind of the mascot. He was the guy that when you're sitting down with investors, you know, you bring in Spielberg and you wow them. He was kind of the sizzle, you know.
Right,
he's the reason, you know, Paul Allen wanted to invest $500 million. So, you know, he had a very strategic role. And Geffen also sort of had this, you know, when we need him, we bring him in. You know, when the negotiations get difficult, bring him in, and he'll scream a little and drive people crazy and solve the problem and get us what we want. So
yeah.
It was, you know, they did have this kind of complementary relationship. But I would say, you know, as far as who was clocking the most hours, undoubtedly Katzenberg.
Yeah, and he's a hard worker too, according to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
right?
Famously, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, like 4 breakfast meetings before 8, you know, gets up at 4,
wow.
You know, returns every phone. Oh, yeah, he's manic.
Yeah. You see, Kara, you don't work as hard as Jeffrey.
I just don't see that ever happening. I just don't see it happening in my life. Would you say that these three men, were they united, or were they kind of, was there a lot of, I mean, obviously it dissolved or was, you know, taken over, like you said, by Paramount, but was there a cohesive working together, or was it constant battling different creative visions? I know, especially because you said, is it too much creative and not enough business personalities going on? Or because, I mean, it's because you said you're really motivated to find out why the resolve, like, why did this not go well? I mean, you have the top three most influential people in Hollywood, and you've got a lot of the creative, you've got the, you know, the tycoons or whatever. Like, with that, were they not cohesive, or were they missing more of a business mind? I mean, obviously they're all business minded, but I mean, more of the nuts and bolts. Were they too creative, or, you know, I'm just trying to kind of put my arms around it a bit. Like,
yeah, I think one of the problems was that they weren't as cohesive as people had expected, and that once they formed the company, especially as time went by, they kind of each went off into their own fiefdoms. I mean, these three guys are, you know, and I talk about this in the prologue, but they're lone wolves. I mean, they've built their careers working for themselves primarily. They're not great team players, or that's not how they became successful.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was, after the, you know, big announcement and all the excitement, when it actually came to running the company, Steven went and ran live action, Jeffrey ran animation, and Geffen kind of hung back and did the deals. And so there was this sense of these three separate empires, and it was obvious, just even in the dynamics of the company, you just saw kind of this separateness. And I mean, people were also very surprised that Spielberg didn't let Jeffrey run live action, which was kind of the big, you know, that's sort of the crown jewel of the studio. And people had expected, oh, well, the guy's run Paramount for 10 years. Disney. He's been at Paramount. You know, but Spielberg made it very clear, no, this is my turf. You know, you stay over in animation. So, yeah, from the very beginning, there was this sense of, oh, well, they're partners, but they're not. You know?
Right, right.
I mean, they do kind of, you know, they have this pride and this kind of sense of what's mine and what's yours and where you belong.
Right. And that's the thing, you know, when you really think about it, I mean, you put like three probably big egos together, you know, people that are lone wolves and stuff. And, yeah, you would expect some problems there, some friction, you know, everybody pulling in their own direction, you
mm-hmm.
know. Wow. So, well, we'll get to how they failed and all that in a little bit. But going back to the beginning, what was the first film that DreamWorks came out with?
It was The Peacemaker, and it came out in 97.
With George Clooney.
George Clooney, who at the time was not nothing. I mean, he was basically the star of ER, but it was one of his
right.
first films. And Spielberg personally asked him to be in the film because Amblin, Spielberg's company, produced ER, so that's how he knew him.
Right.
And it was directed by Mimi Leder. But it was a surprising film. I think it came out, so DreamWorks was formed in 94. The first film didn't come out till 97, so it was this long delay, and everyone was sort of wondering, like, what's going on?
Was yeah, what are you
so
guys
long?
Doing there?
Yeah, what's up? And also there was this surprise that, wow, that's your first film. I mean, it was a fine film. It's nicely made, but it's basically a sort of standard thriller.
Right.
You know, with these people who, and Nicole Kidman at that time was best known as being Tom Cruise's wife.
Right.
So, you know, no huge movie stars. Mimi Leder, who it was her first direct, you know, she was a director of ER, so it was her first time directing a feature, and it was just kind of this fine movie, and mm-hmm. it was like, wow, that's, you know, there was definitely a sense of disappointment and, like, you know, sort of let down, you know, just after all that hype that was their first film out of the gate.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would have expected maybe
Was it good? It's not good.
You're fine. It's not bad,
it's not,
but you're
yeah, but
you're fine.
Not.
I mean, it's you would never, you know, I don't think it's something
it's
that
kind of one of those like
not memorable.
It's
by
a little
any
mediocre
means,
kind of. Or?
Kind of not gonna really. You're not gonna be talking about it days after.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I was like, oh man, I didn't hear about this.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. No, I
so
just remember something with
opening.
A train and a nuclear bomb.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah,
that's
and
actually
that.
That's yeah. more than I remember.
Somewhere
remember
in Europe,
that.
I remember with the train and everything. So
it's yeah. just a really big anticlimactic kind of opening.
Yeah, just well, the whole thing about DreamWorks 2 was that, and they would complain a lot that, well, everyone just expects so much of us, you know, that everyone puts us, you know, holds us to a higher standard, you know, that if any other studio had released that film, no one would have said, you know, anything. But,
right.
but because it's DreamWorks, like, oh my God, that's horrible, you know. But that's how it is when you've got those three guys. You
yeah.
know? I mean.
Now, wouldn't you have expected the first film to be directed by Spielberg or something? I mean, you know, it makes sense, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what people thought. But he was actually kind of kicking back when DreamWorks formed. Spielberg has this habit where he works back to back. He'll direct two or three films and literally back to back. And so he had done Schindler's List and then it went directly to Jurassic Park, or it may have been the other way around. I can't remember.
I think you said Jurassic Park came after that.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So he does, but he constantly does this. I mean, if you look, just go on IMDb or just look at his history, it's always two to three, you know, where he just knocks himself out and then he takes time off. So he takes a few years to kind of, you
I
know,
see.
Step back, be with his family, you know, figure out what the next project is, which makes perfect sense and it's fine, except when you're running a studio.
Yeah.
And except when that sort of respite period comes right as your studio is forming.
Right.
So he was not, you know, I talked to a lot of people who worked for DreamWorks Interactive, which was the video game division, and they loved it because Spielberg wasn't directing movies. So he'd literally come by the office, and Spielberg loves to play video games and just play for hours with them.
Right.
Or, you know, come in and just like, oh, you guys, I got to level 15 of Mech Warrior. You know, but it was curious because you're thinking, wow, that's really cool. But then you're like, but meanwhile, the studio needs to be formed, and Jeffrey Katzenberg's running around trying to build this thing, and Spielberg's playing video games.
Right.
Like, you know, so yeah, his first film also came late in 1997. That was Amistad, which is not one of his finer films, or didn't do that well. But
right.
Yeah, he took a while to warm up.
Yeah. Now, did he retain Amblin Entertainment during this time as well? I mean, was there like any conflict of interest going on?
No, Amblin, he kept the name, but it sort of, a lot of Amblin projects just became DreamWorks projects.
I see.
But he did, interestingly, keep, you know, the Amblin headquarters, which is the spa I was referring to earlier, That remained the DreamWorks headquarters for live action. There were plans early on to build this big studio in Playa Vista, but when that didn't work out, they just kept Amblin. So Spielberg has never left Amblin, and a lot of people thought that was, you know, as DreamWorks, as the years went by, and they felt Spielberg was kind of less excited about the company because it wasn't doing as well, and, you know, sort of drifting or making a lot of movies for other studios. I mean, people said, you know, symbolically it was a shame that DreamWorks had never built its own studio because keeping Spielberg at Amblin just sort of, you know, it sort of kept him in that mindset of Amblin, of, you know, I'm at Universal, and it sort of, people felt that if he'd had his own studio, you know, that was a whole new thing and a new identity, there might have been more sort of emotional investment or, you know, in just really working exclusively for that studio and not just continuing to work as a director for other studios, which he did, you know, even after DreamWorks was formed, he was directing films for Fox and Paramount and these other places. So it sort of, you know, people lamented that.
Yeah. Wow. So now they stayed on the Universal lot. Did Universal have any stake in the company?
No. After that, I mean, once DreamWorks was formed, you know, Universal wasn't paying for the rent anymore, basically, or the overhead. I mean, DreamWorks was, you know,
They were just leasing out the space?
Yeah, Universal. Exactly.
I see.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Yeah. So from what I understand in the book, they also decided to keep the company private as well, right? So they didn't have to show any figures. They didn't have to show any numbers and so forth. So did that give them some kind of a reputation as being secretive or holding things close?
Yeah. I mean, DreamWorks is very private. Like I said, Paul Allen was putting up most of the money. So they didn't. Yeah, they definitely had this attitude of, you know, we don't owe anyone numbers. No one needs to know.
Right.
You know, unlike, say, Warner Brothers or Sony, who are, you know, public companies, so they have to have earnings reports, and you literally just have these numbers come out of, you know, how they're doing. DreamWorks didn't, you know, and it was their right, but they definitely took, that was their attitude. It was sort of this, you know, elitist kind of, you know, we don't owe you guys anything. So
right.
Don't, and they would, you know, they were furious whenever there were leaks from the company or the press would get hold of anything or, you know, the few times that information would get out because the company wasn't doing that well. I mean, they just were spending so much money.
Really?
So, you know, it was very convenient that they did not have to release numbers.
Yeah. What were they spending money on? I mean, it sounds like, you know, they would... You know, they would have some business sense after making so many movies and stuff, so...
Well, their overhead was always enormous. I mean, for a studio that was only making, you know, at most 10 movies a year, at some years it was 6 movies. I mean, think about it. The majors release 20 to 30 films a year.
Really?
So this studio that's acting like a boutique, but they always had, you know, 800 employees, and they paid for everybody's lunch, and they built this beautiful animation studio out in Glendale... And, you know, they were just big on perks. You know, they had they had the private jets. Everybody flew first class, at least in the beginning. I mean, slowly it kind of, you know, the money people came in and sort of put an end to it. But it was always, you know, people who worked there loved it. It was,
yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, endless perks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so they were never a frugal company. And then, you know, they didn't have a library. So they didn't, you know, the way studios like Paramount or Columbia or MGM, you know, they make money, you know, when they need money or when it's a bad year, they always have these libraries of hundreds and hundreds of films that, you know, they're selling to pay TV or it's DVD, and there's constant money coming in. Or, you know, like Columbia did Jeopardy. So you have these residuals. So that's,
I see.
That money is what keeps you stable because, you know, movies are a risky business. There's, you know, you're never going to have a, you know, you're not, everyone is not going to be profitable. That's just the way it is. But DreamWorks didn't have that because they were starting from scratch. So it was just a combination of, you know, spending that much money, being so lavish, not producing a lot of films, and not having that you know, reliable income stream from a library.
Right. So now they had animation, the animation part of the company. Then they had the live action. They also had video games, right?
Yeah.
Which failed miserably, probably, right? I never heard of them releasing any game that was popular or anything.
Yeah, they had Trespasser. They had, you know, that was a very short-lived operation. Although it was one of my favorite stories or things I learned researching was that, you know, the game The Sims.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
city thing. I think people build a city.
Yeah, and you kind of you have relationships with people.
I almost lost a relationship over that video game because I was like, hey, there's real life out here, and I need you to engage right now.
Right?
He's like, oh, I'm building houses with people. I'm watering my crops. I don't know what it is. To me, it was the equivalent of what Facebook has as a freaking Farmville.
Exactly. Yeah, it was like a right. But when that came out, which I think was in 2000, that was a huge, it was like the highest selling video game ever. It was this huge phenomenon. I remember David Brooks was writing about in the New York Times. It was just this huge thing. Mm. But interestingly, Spielberg had come up with basically the same idea like 5 years before. And this is when he was, in his video game period and spending a lot of time with the gamers at DreamWorks. And apparently he came in one day and said, you guys are all into making these games where you shoot things up and you kill people and there's aliens. Like, why don't we just make a game where it's just real life? Your kid's sick. You have to take him to the hospital. the trash is full. You got to take it out. And these gamers were just like, are you kidding? Of course it's Spielberg. So it's like, oh, great idea. Great. Brilliant. But he would leave and they'd be like, what? What is he talking about? So but they started working on it, totally unsure of how to do this, and they hired Nora Ephron, of all people, to come write the script, because they figured, she knows about relationships, so let's get her involved. She's friends with Spielberg. So they worked on it for a while, and then in the end it was scrapped, but then a few years later The Sims came out, and everyone was just going, oh my God, that was exactly what Spielberg had in mind, and it just, didn't happen.
And it became, but The Sims is hugely successful, right?
Yeah,
it has been. I never realized it was their game.
Well, no, I'm saying it's not their game.
It wasn't their game.
No.
Had
the same
but
concept,
he wanted
right?
something like that.
He wanted basically the same thing, and then it just, they couldn't quite crack it, and then DreamWorks Interactive ended up being sold, so it just went away. But then, a few years later, somebody else kind of came up with the same thing, and it was huge. So it was just... it's a sign that Spielberg does, creatively, he really does have this kind of intuition and sort of knows what engages people and sort of what works as entertainment.
Right. And then was Shrek their first animated movie, or did they have... No, huh?
They had several, right?
So they had a few that bombed?
They had many bombs.
Really?
Shrek was that took a while. That came out in 2001. But it took a while. I think it was really humbling for Katzenberg because he'd come from Disney and it had just been hit after hit after hit with Lion King and Little Mermaid and Aladdin. And then he goes to DreamWorks and, expects kind of the same success. And they took a lot of Disney animators. They really sort of poached people from Disney. So you had a lot of the same people working together, but it just didn't work. So the first one was The Prince of Egypt, which did not, did okay, but it just
but
wasn't.
Not great.
Yeah, and then The Road to El Dorado, which was a total bomb. They had this film Spirit, so it was really, it was kind of embarrassing actually.
Yeah.
But then Shrek came in 2001 and it was a huge hit. And
friggin' love Shrek.
Yeah. I know.
Who doesn't love Shrek? You love Shrek? You love Shrek. Thank you for doing Shrek. So they're not a failure in my eyes.
I know. And the pussycat. I loved him being fat this time.
Oh, little chunker, huh? little chunk-a-lunk, little fat deuce.
I want that character just, with me at all times.
Oh, man. Shrek it just made the whole animated world, too, just much more, I just think, more broad and comedic and...
Yeah.
I think digestible for all ages as opposed to being a little more for kids. I just think it's
Yeah, well, it's really irreverent and wise ass and, there are just things in there that are kind of, it's very edgy.
But it's still endearing. It's not like, some of the adult cartoons that are just so heartless. It still was very lovable, even though it was adaptable for adults. That's what I really like about it too.
That was a hit for them.
And then later they came out with Ants, which was probably bad timing because The Bug's Life was just coming out with from Pixar.
Yeah,
and they had to compete with that.
Yeah, that was also one of the early ones. And this is before when you were saying why I wanted to write the book. Another theme that I just was fascinated by is the whole DreamWorks history, there's always this battle with Disney and Pixar, which with the time, early on, Disney was distributing Pixar's film. Now Disney owns Pixar, but it was always this battle. And one of the first ones was DreamWorks was making Ants and Pixar was making A Bug's Life. And they were literally, as the name suggests, very similar
very
films.
Very similar.
Yeah, and so there was literally this war to beat, DreamWorks made there was a war to beat Pixar to the theaters, mm-hmm. and sort of so they rushed Ants, and they just had everybody hands on deck, all out, you know, working around the clock to like get this thing finished and beat and sort of, you know, get it out before A Bug's Life.
Bug's Life was better. I saw them both.
Yeah, it did do better.
It did do better. Yeah.
It was
yeah.
a good. It was a better movie. Ants was cute, but it didn't hold. I mean, Bug's Life. I mean, well, who ordered the poo poo platter? Like, I remember lines. I mean, that's good.
Well, Pixar is tough to beat.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, they're pretty.
So how would you explain those bombs when you have Jeffrey Katzenberg in charge?
Well, I think one thing that happened when Jeffrey went to DreamWorks was that he early on he made the mistake of thinking he was a creative person, and instead of hiring someone like a John Lasseter at Pixar or you know a real creative head for animation, he thought he would be that person, and you know because he had just come from Disney where he'd overseen these films, but as I was saying earlier, when he got to DreamWorks, he wasn't just overseeing them, I mean, he was literally in, you know, working with the animators all day long and, you know, ordering things to be ripped up and cut and commenting on lines. And, you know, I remember like someone telling me for Ants, you know, commenting on the size of the ants' eyeballs. Like, you know, and he's just, as much of a genius he is as a businessman and as an executive, he's not a creative genius. I think that's
some people
got to
get a reality check. You got to get a reality check and know your level. My friend said this. She went on this date with this dude, and it was a blind date. The dude totally into her. He's 5'6" and Asian, and she's a tall black woman that's built with a big fro. And she goes, "What's this short little Asian man gonna do with all this?" Mm. She said, "No." She goes, "Know your level."
Right.
And I mean, it really. But there's a lot
of
people.
How did he take that?
Well, she didn't tell him that. Okay. She told me that. But okay. they're friends. But what I've found in Hollywood in doing creative stuff is that everybody wants to be the DP. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to be the director. Everybody wants to be the marketing director. That everybody wants to do everything and thinks that they can rule the world.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like realizing, you know, some people are gifted and they're creative geniuses, and some people are numbers people. And there's maybe some gray area where you have, you know, side skills that you're good at, but maybe you're not that, like, you know, the mecca of it all. And I think that's totally proves what I was trying to say.
It's a total Hollywood phenomenon. It's so true. I mean, every writer really wants to be a director. Every director wants to, you know, run a studio. Every studio wants, you know, it's absolutely. I mean, in Hollywood, I think it's even more. I mean, you just see it everywhere. So yeah, Jeffrey kind of suffered from that.
Right. Now, in the book, I mean, the whole book really is how they rose and then they failed. Now, can you talk a little bit about the failure? Because I mean, I wasn't really up on what's going on with DreamWorks lately, so to me it didn't even seem like they failed at a certain point, but talk a little bit about that.
Well, they for a lot of the reasons I've been talking about, just the spending and you know, not having a real CFO type, you know, to kind of be watching the spending and really sort of managing the place, as time went by, they became more lean. So this big operation, you know, they shut the video game operation, the TV studio became much smaller. They sold the record label. I mean, just almost every year they would just kind of strip it back. And again, when you're only making 6 movies a year, there are going to be some bad years. And in fact, there were. And a lot of people blame the couple who were running the live action studio, Walter Parks and Laurie MacDonald, who were Spielberg's very good friends. But had never run a studio before. Walter Parks was a, you know, Oscar-nominated screenwriter. He'd been a producer, as had Laurie, who'd briefly worked at Columbia, but they'd never worked at a studio. And suddenly they're managing this thing, and they just, you know, Walter, I think, is a really brilliant guy and very talented, but he's not a great manager. And so it was showing in the films. It was showing the years they only had 6 movies, and you know the movies weren't working. So as time went by, they just reached a point where it just made no sense to be an independent studio. And also they needed to pay people back. So Paul Allen needed his money back. So they spun off the animation studio in 2004. And I think once animation left, it made no sense.
It wasn't the same anymore, huh?
Yeah, there was no justification. I mean, they were basically the size of a production company. So just become a production company and let someone buy you. So that's when they were sold to Paramount. So it's you know, it's however you want to define failure. They had great films in there, but if you look at what they set out to do, did they accomplish that? No.
Right.
So I don't, you know, it's open, it's sort of open for interpretation, but not really.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you how you define success, I mean, you're right. If they were going after the you know the goal and they didn't reach that goal, then yeah. But I think you know there's some beautiful things that came out of it. Obviously, we're not debating that, but
right.
I still think it's. I just like seeing people just go all in on stuff and be like, yeah, let's do it. Let's take over the damn world. We've already done this.
Right.
Come on now. Hey, Jeff, get off the pool. Let's do it.
Yeah,
I like
right,
it. Come on. Right. Hey. Can you, you know, put down the private jet. Let's go try something new.
Right.
Ah, shit, didn't work. Let's just go back to our yacht.
Yeah.
You know, life
yeah.
is good. And I just think, you know, go after it. I like the whole big, mm-hmm. big, go big or go home. But I'm from Texas, so that's what they do.
No, it's true. It's,
yeah. So now what appealed to Paramount about the company? I mean, why would they buy them? They obviously didn't do real well and stuff. And were they actually buying the guys that were running it? Or what was that about?
They were, what was appealing, there were a few things. I mean, at the time, Brad Gray had just arrived at Paramount, and Paramount was, they had nothing in the pipeline. They needed material, they needed product, and, Brad Gray, there were a lot of image problems over there. There were a lot of sort of executive upheaval, people being fired, when Gray arrived, there were people, you know, just massive overhaul of the studio and showing up in the press, and I think Brad saw, you know, wisely in DreamWorks, a product. We buy DreamWorks. We've got movies. You know, they've got movies ready to go. And most importantly, Spielberg. So it's a
right.
big, splashy, we're going to be in the Steven Spielberg business. So definitely, you know, as far as what they were buying, I think, you know, Spielberg was probably the number one, you know, the number one reason. But also just to have these movies and have that name. And DreamWorks for, you know, whatever you want to say about it, it did, you know, I think people do associate it with good films and you know, sort of more upscale films. So that was the appeal.
I see. And so is it still DreamWorks as a separate company at Paramount?
It's so complicated.
Oh, it is? Okay, well, we don't have time to get into that.
No, anyway, they're not at Paramount. Now it's like DreamWorks, you know, 2.0. They're
really?
Now actually, that was a terrible, disastrous marriage for 2 years. So DreamWorks left Paramount. Geffen has left DreamWorks. It's really just Spielberg and Stacey Snyder. They have a production company, and Disney, ironically, distributes its films. But now it's almost back to being what Amblin was.
I see.
You know, that sort of size and scope.
And what's Katzenberg doing these days?
When DreamWorks Animation became a public company, he runs that. So he sort of has his fiefdom. So yeah, they've all kind of returned to their corners.
I see. Okay. Well, that's fascinating.
It is very, very fascinating.
And you worried what you talk about for 50 minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Are we done?
I think we'd have another hour to just
loaded.
Cover this.
Loaded.
I mean, this book is loaded with stuff. And so what's in the works for you now? I mean, now you obviously will never work in this town again.
Right. I'm hanging out by the pool.
Get your pool and that Mai Tai on.
Have
you had any backlash? I mean, some major backlash career-wise?
Russell Crowe has been my most fun backlash. He tweeted, because there's the stuff in there about Gladiator doesn't make him look good, and he tweeted when he first saw it that I was a quote, lying horse's ass. So that was great.
Very nice, yeah.
So that's been...
Hey, you get him talking, girl.
I know.
And
yeah.
Something struck. Something struck.
Yeah, well, he's not exactly perceived as a
He doesn't have a good track record. Just own it, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I think it gives you more credit by talking
about
it.
I'm totally owning it. I love it.
Yeah, that's hysterical.
Well, Nicole Laporte, thank you so much for
your
time.
Thank you,
really appreciate this. Congratulations on the book. I know it's doing very well. And maybe you can just retire off the book and you don't have to work in this town again.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
Thank you so Everybody much.
Everybody go out and get The Men Who Would Be King. And it's Nicole Laporte, of course. And this is it, I guess, for this week.
I'll see you, my
And name. Next week, we're going to start at 10, so be here then. And we'll see you all on Monday.
You have been listening to Sam and Kara in the Morning, which airs every weekday from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, originating from the Los Angeles Talk Radio studios. If you have questions about the show or would like to inquire about sponsorship opportunities, please direct all correspondence to info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Kara in the Morning is a production of LA Talk Radio. We say what we want. We'll be right back.